Hello, my name is Mahira Muzikar. My favorite thing is to read, write, and watch zombie movies.
Welcome to the Finding Favorites podcast, where we explore your favorite things without using an algorithm. Here's your host, Leah Jones.
Hello, and welcome to Finding Favorites. I'm your host, Leah Jones, and it is Sunday, November 14th. It is booster day in the Jones household. I got up early this morning, went to Jewel for my scheduled Pfizer booster, and got my booster. And then mid-edit, made a mistake of sitting down in my recliner and took a Pfizer booster nap. But I'm so happy to have the booster. Now, I'll admit, it could have also been a post-chemo nap. Friday afternoon was my first treatment of chemo. I got Taxol for my breast cancer, or it's my breast cancer treatment. And they pump you full of steroids every time you get an infusion. And so I definitely know that steroids are kind of winding down at the same time that the COVID booster is hitting my immune system. So maybe I didn't plan that great, but the best time to get the booster is the time you got the booster. I wrote all about my experience of getting chemo on my Caring Bridge account, so I will just link to that in the show notes instead of going into it in audio form as well. Already tired of telling the story of the first infusion because it was a long, boring day until it was not boring. And then it was a very exciting 4 minutes, and then the day wrapped up pretty soon thereafter. But I'm here. I'm feeling pretty good. It is pitch dark out already. Time change last weekend really threw me for a loop. And but I'm doing well. I'm really grateful for the incredible gifts of my community taking care of me since I got this diagnosis in June and had surgeries in September and October, and now 12 weeks of chemo, one down, 11 weeks to go, and this part of the treatment. A question I've had is why chemo, if it was just stage one and they got all of it in the lumpectomy? And because of the combination of being estrogen reactive and HER2 positive, though progesterone negative, the combination of markers in my cancer said, the research currently says that chemo really helps stop it from recurring in the next 5 years. Northwestern has done the research. They've tried to do this one with surgery and radiation only, and that is not effective enough for my medical oncologist. And I would rather just have one bummer year of cancer treatment now than just do a lumpectomy and radiation and cross my fingers. So that's why I chose to go ahead with chemotherapy. I know it's not the choice that everyone would make, but that is kind of where my risk tolerance is. So today I have Mayar Amuzigar on. He is an author, professor, provost, man of the, truly a man of the world. He grew up in Tehran in Iran, immigrated to the United States as a teenager in the 70s, right before the revolution, spent a few years in New Zealand. His daughters live there now, and now he lives in New Orleans. We are talking about his new book coming out in December, and zombie movies. And it's just a delightful conversation. I'm envious of the folks on campus in New Orleans who get to either have taken classes with him or get to be on faculty with him. His book comes out December 4th. You can pre-order it now from Bookshop. That is what I've done. I was reading the PDF, and I am excited to get my hands on the paperback and start reading in a couple weeks. So enjoy this interview with Mayar, and please wear your mask, wash your hands, get your COVID booster, and get those kids vaccinated. What an exciting time to have access to vaccines. And with that, enjoy this conversation. Hello and welcome to Finding Favorites. I'm your host, Leah Jones, and this is the podcast where we learn about people's favorite things and we get recommendations without using an algorithm. Today, I am joined by Mayar Amuzegar. He is the provost of the University of New Orleans. He is an Iranian-American writer who lives both in the United States and New Zealand, which I'm very curious about. He's the author of three previous novels, Dinner at 1032, A Dark Sunny Afternoon, and Pisgah Road. His newest book is a selection of short stories and called The Hubris of an Empty Hand, and it is available on November 18th. Mayar, how are you doing this evening?
Doing well, thank you.
So you are the provost of University of New Orleans.
That is correct.
What a weird time to be a university official. Is that an understatement?
Yes, I know. It's been an interesting journey.
Yeah.
We learned a lot about the campus. We learned about a lot about our students. And I'm proud of the fact that our faculty and staff and students have done amazingly well in the past 18 months. Mm-hmm. Obviously, in spring of 2020, we were very worried about how we're going to function. But genuinely, they've all been very good. I'm very surprised and yet pleasantly surprised at how well we've done. We're in a system of 9 universities. Mm-hmm. We've done the best in terms of COVID numbers.
Good.
And we've done really well in terms of making sure, despite living online pretty much in the mm-hmm. past year, that we still keep a community together.
So. Yeah. Yeah. And how did, so the very beginning of my career, I was a hall director, and I thought my life path was going to be the housing to dean of students, student affairs path. And I found out after a couple years it wasn't where my life was going. But how did you, because you are a mathematician, an engineer, and a fiction writer, how did your path come to becoming a provost?
That's a good question. So I think if I was born in the States, or if maybe my parents would have come to the States when they were much younger, mm-hmm. I probably would have gone to be a historian or be a creative writer.
Okay.
But when you're growing up in Iran, and my parents never forced me, but it was always implied that we're either going to be doctors or engineers.
Okay.
So I grew up thinking either I'm going to be a doctor or engineer. So I end up being neither, but more of a mathematician than anything mm-hmm. else. But I always loved writing. So I've been writing since the childhood. But it seems like as an immigrant, that's the path to go to make money,
yeah.
to be successful. So initially I thought, oh, I'm going to be just a normal, you know, mathematician, win a field medal, which mm-hmm. never happened, of course, have my doctoral students and just do normal academic thing while yeah. writing for myself. But, you know, just sort of zigzagging through life. When I was mm-hmm. a junior faculty, I thought, how come all the suits on campus never listened to me or anybody mm-hmm. else? So I thought when I wore those suits and become a leadership on campus, I'm going to do it differently. So it was yeah. more of a vengeance against the man that I want to take this job to show them how it's done. You know?
Yeah. And when did you come over from Tehran?
So we came, my brother and I came in 1978, right? Mm-hmm. Before, about 9 months before the revolution.
Okay.
So I was almost 14. I'm now 57, 58, mm-hmm. I think. So it's been a while. Yeah, and it was just really, initially was my sisters were living here, and the idea was just to come and visit.
Mm-hmm.
And they just, something happened, and things went this way and that way, and we decided to stay. And the idea was my parents would come as well. It didn't happen. It took them a long time.
Yeah. So they didn't,
They didn't come for the, no.
They weren't here on the vacation.
No, it was just me and my sisters and my brother, my sister was living here already.
Yeah.
The idea was my parents would come quickly. It just took 10 years or so for it to happen.
Yeah. Well, it's certainly, I've done some support of, a friend of mine is a psychologist who does, he's an expert witness in immigration cases on the psychological pain of the immigration system. And so from that, I've learned some stories of people, you know, people with who maybe came for the first time 20 or 30 years ago, and just what a struggle it is to emigrate to this, to here. Mm-hmm. I mean, to most countries, but that's opened the door a little bit for me to have some imagination of what that decade would have been like, and waiting to get your parents over.
Yeah. I think, you know, my brother and I have had easier time. I think it was easier to come to the country than people, maybe the more recent immigrants, but you're right. But also in the 70s, I remember, you know, when I got here, freshman year, ninth grade, nobody knew where Iran was. I remember standing up in front of a map, showing to my class. Well, you know, I think more and more people know who Iranians are, especially if you live in California, you know, that's, you know, or New York, a lot of Iranians. So has made it, I think, maybe somewhat easier in terms of people coming here. And when I moved to California, I remember there were so few of us that when you hear Farsi in the street, you will stop and talk to each other. My God. But now it's like, my God, too common.
Now there's too many people.
Yeah, there are too many of us now. We have become dime a dozen for sure. Yes.
Yeah. And then how did New Zealand get folded into your world?
So when I was getting my PhD, when I finished my PhD, we already married and had two children, two daughters. And we're looking for jobs. And the only jobs, that was in the mid 90s, the only jobs I could find was either in Texas or Florida. Mm-hmm. Which wasn't going to happen for me. I was not going to go to Texas or Florida.
So. Yeah.
And during the Los Angeles earthquake, all of us in the family housing, we got out of our apartments. And then there were a couple of Kiwis who were passing out orange juice and just chatting. And they said, hey, one of my friends in New Zealand is leaving the country and the job is open. And she happened to be exact same field as I am. So I applied.
Wow.
Yeah, applied. That was before Zoom, before, you know.
Yeah.
I got the job, never visited New Zealand. We packed up the whole family and moved to New Zealand.
Wow.
Yeah.
So how long were you in New Zealand?
So we lived there 4 years.
Yeah.
And then I got a job with the RAND Corporation. So I really wanted to come back.
Yeah.
But since then, though, we kept our house. We moving. Every year we go there for vacation.
Mm-hmm.
When my daughters started college, they went to UC Santa Cruz for 1 year, but I told them, I cajoled them to go to New Zealand.
Uh-huh.
And at first there were a bit resistance, but they're there now and they've been there for 10 years. They love it. They're not coming back. So hence we need to go. Yes. Hence having two worlds for me.
Oh, that's nice. It's it also must feel good as a father to have them in a country that's really handled COVID well.
Oh, that's for sure. That's for sure. Yeah. Up until recently, they were pretty much lived in an island, literally and figuratively, in a world that most people haven't experienced for the past 18 months. When I went there in the past year, it's amazing. After the quarantine, you get out and you're free, you're back to normal.
Mm-hmm.
And the country is living a normal life. And then you come back to the States and the whole masking, you know, all the other issues that,
I have a friend who he's a Kiwi, and so he's just did the quarantine and posting pictures of, you know, like when they got to go to the yard to do their walks and the meals he was getting and the arguments he was getting with people during exercise time about masking and not masking and the benefits of quarantine. And but it's working. So you can't
argue with that. No, definitely. They live really different lives than we do, lives that we do. Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about this book. You're coming up on, you're about a month away from publication day. I almost missed the Zoom because I started, this isn't a book review podcast, but I was like, oh, it's short stories. I'll dive in. And I was like, you have to stop reading. It's I'm just reading the first one right now with Amani and Dahlia and Jackie. And I had to wrestle myself away from it. So why this time short stories? You've done novels in the past. Have you always written short stories or?
No, not. In fact, every time I start a short story, end up being a full
novel. Turns into a novel.
Because I can't stop writing. I have. And this one wasn't meant to be a short story.
It just
that ends up being one set of short stories. I was never trained as a writer. So I try to emulate good writers that try to read.
Yeah.
And so every time I start a new one, I try to write it as organically as possible.
Mm-hmm.
I generally spend a year with my characters before even I write a single word. Every night I go to bed, I start a conversation and sort of continue with the conversation. And so the idea was this. And then I challenged myself with something that I've never done before.
Mm-hmm.
And for this one, I thought, because for the longest time, I spent a lot of time with Jackie in particular, just a lot of conversation. What does she want?
Yeah.
And then I challenged myself if I could write a set of short stories that a reader can read as independent short stories. Mm-hmm. But if you put them together, it can be read as a novel.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm hoping there's a big arc that covers the whole book.
Yeah.
So it's a novel. And then you'll be able to read each of the stories independently and not sequentially. So I don't know whether that was successful, but that was the that was the goal.
How much of this was written during COVID?
A little bit of it, not too much of it.
Okay. That's nice. I'll be interested to see what art comes out of this time. If this time ever ends, you know.
Right, exactly. I think it's too early. I'm sure people have started writing already, but by the time I finish the book, it was already finished and it was with the publishers for edits and everything else.
So, oh, good.
Yeah.
Are you able to have an in-person launch in New Orleans or are you going to do, what sort of launch events are you able to plan this year?
We are hoping to have an in-person launch early December in Octavia Bookstore, which is a supporter and a local bookstore.
Yeah.
So we're hoping to be in person. We're going to require vaccination proof, of course. So that would be, we tried with the last book 2 years ago. And of course, as soon as that was in April of 2020, of course, everything was canceled.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
So we're hopeful. Yeah.
Yeah. Things seem to be trending that way.
Yeah. And New Orleans is doing well, relatively speaking. The mayor has done a good job, I think.
Yeah, I feel really great. I'm in Illinois, and so our governor is J.B. Pritzker, who we had a billionaire Republican governor who destroyed the state, and then I really half-heartedly voted for J.B. because I don't think Like, what we need is not more billionaires in public office. But truly, every step of the way, he's impressed me. Mm-hmm. And there is something, I guess, to be said for a billionaire who can't be bought just following the science and actually doing the right thing. So Illinois, kind of despite ourselves, got through pretty, like, we've had good leadership. I feel pretty safe. Chicago's got a pretty high vaccine rate. I'm lucky to work somewhere that I've been working from home since March of 2020. So,
yeah, like, you know, COVID, like everything else, is, you know, it was for people like ourselves, it wasn't horrible because we can work at home, we get our paycheck. It is easy to, and for obviously for a lot of people, it's not the case. And so, as usual, and that's obviously with our students. Yeah.
So, as a provost, how have you stuck it to the man? Now, you said you, when I'm wearing that suit on campus, I'm going to do things differently. Do you think you have a different type of relationships with your students or faculty than you saw when you were a student or faculty?
I'm hoping. I hope so. I mean, I do say I'm trying to stick it to the man, and my staff say, you are the man. So that's like, I'm trying to stick it to myself, I guess, in some ways. I try, as I said, you know, when I was younger and I was just starting my career, the idea is that I wanted to be part of a team. Mm-hmm. And you may ignore my ideas, but at least hear my ideas.
Yep.
So I try as much as possible to be, you know, listen to faculty, staff, students. Before COVID, I used to have weekly luncheon with my faculty and staff. They would self-select themselves, 12, 13 of them every week, a couple of lunches, three lunches, and no agenda, just chat. Mm-hmm. That was my way of saying, I want to hear what you have to say. Tell me, you know, I may not be able to do it, but I want to hear you.
Yeah.
So I've tried. I don't know what, if you ask my faculty and staff, what they would say, I hope they say, at least it's trying.
it's so hard. I'm so far from it now. I'm about 20 years out from working in student affairs, but it's just so different. And I can't imagine I don't know. Campuses have changed so much since I was a student in the 90s and since I was on staff in 2000, 2001. You know, I had students in Colorado who were Columbine survivors.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Who came straight from Columbine to their freshman year at Fort Lewis. But it was still such an outlier event. It wasn't something that had traumatized like a whole generation of students. Mm-hmm. And now this COVID. So it just seems, I'm a huge believer in the on-campus experience, and the value of that, but it's really the ability of faculties and administration to make that pivot to online to help people keep moving forward was tremendous.
Yeah. People have done a great job, I think. Again, part of it with New Orleans is because they experienced Katrina.
Mm-hmm.
And they had to sort of go online at that time.
Right.
So in some ways, we were ready for it because we're always ready for hurricanes and moving everything online. So in some ways, it was somewhat easier for us. Mm-hmm. As I mentioned earlier, we realize there are so much seams and so, you know, between what we thought our students have and what they don't have. So I think everybody will tell you this, the gap between the have and have nots become even more clear during COVID. But it was an opportunity, as a silver lining, it's the opportunity for us to do things that we wouldn't have done before and to help students, to help staff, et cetera.
Great. Well, Mayar, we're here to talk about, for me to grill you about life as an administrator and your new book. But we're also here to talk about your favorite thing. So what is something that you love or a favorite thing that you would like to talk about a little bit tonight?
I think my favorite things would be, if you don't mind saying more than one.
Yeah, of course.
So my favorite things to do is, not in that order, reading, writing, and watching zombie movies.
Reading, writing, and watching zombie movies.
Yes. I get a great delight in watching zombies because, as I said, at heart, I would have wanted to be a historian or sociologist.
Yeah.
I love the sociological aspect of sort of the world, not necessarily zombie, obviously, that's not possible, but
right.
The world that they've created. It just fascinates me how human behavior and in a dystopian world would work.
So. Yeah. What's the first zombie movie you remember seeing?
Oh, that's a good question. Probably Dawn of the Dead or maybe Night of the Living Dead.
Yeah.
Romero's original.
Mm-hmm.
I remember watching it maybe as a child, but I don't think it impressed me as much as...
Mm-hmm.
The zombie thing is more of a recent phenomenon,
okay.
20 years or so. So I remember watching it, but it wasn't as impressive, I would say, but it's
sure.
My word to use, watching zombie movies, than rewatching it again.
Yeah.
So Romero's, I know that his movie is not the first zombie movie, there are 1,000 before him, but he set the tone.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that it's black and white, and it's not really about the goriness of it, but more about the interaction of human beings.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of impressive. Yeah, so that was my first, I think.
Yeah. And what are the pieces of world building in zombie movies that, do you think there are some things that if it doesn't have this, it's not a good zombie movie? Like, what are the things that you think the really good stories and zombie stories and those dystopian futures take into account?
To me, just in general, and I can give you specifically, but like, to me, in general, any science fiction movie has to, by the sake fact that it's science fiction, so it will be something fictional. But as long as there's consistency in their laws and policies and regulations and everything else they do.
Mm.
So if you want to get rid of gravity, fine, but get rid of gravity throughout. You cannot have it here and there.
Right.
So with zombie movies, too. So the idea, the consistency in terms of how they create it and how we're behaving, and rather than just sort of making it up to help the plot to move
mm-hmm.
forward, which sometimes bad ones do. And sometimes they're funny, so that's fine. You can do what
yeah.
you want to for the funny ones. But so one of the reasons, for example, I like The Walking Dead, the TV show, is because they're very amazingly good and consistent about their rules.
Mm.
They follow. So you can, and in some ways you can put aside the zombie part of the movie.
Yeah.
Yes, they're there. They're the danger. But they're consistent on how they're dangerous to us.
Yeah.
But then how we human beings are behaving in respect to what has happened is just what's fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, that makes for a great zombie movie. The one who are not funny, like Shaun of the Dead, which is a comedy. You know, that's
right.
Fine. You can do what you want to. You know?
So yeah. you want consistent rules.
Yes.
So
nothing worse than science fiction that don't follow the rules.
Yeah, because you don't. It's very unsatisfying when at the end of a book or a movie, there's like a deus machina. Something happens and it's like, well, that doesn't follow any of the, it doesn't, the rules of the world you just ignored to finish writing.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. I think in movie business, there's a term for it, but I don't remember the term, but like all of a sudden somebody by accident sees this message that they wouldn't normally seen it, but they see it because otherwise the plot won't move forward.
Right.
Versus the writer spending some time to make it more clever.
Right? Yeah.
So I think the zombie movies as well. Sometimes I think writers or directors or whoever, they get lazy about the process and they just want to stick it in there.
Mm-hmm.
So if the zombies can run fast, great, even though I'm not a fan of that. I think that was against the traditional zombie.
Right.
But like the one Brad Pitt movie was, you know, they were moving really fast. So that's great. You know, World War Z, yeah. That's fine. But they were consistent about that. And the rationale why they can run fast, but that never was sort of clear why they're running fast, or why they're thinking, why they're doing this. So to me, it's like, explain, why did you decide you give them this kind of characteristic?
Mm-hmm. Did with The Walking Dead, did you read the comic books along with it, or are you TV?
No, not at all.
Okay.
I'm a TV. I don't even watch them, because what I like about The Walking Dead is because they kill off favorite characters all the time.
Mm-hmm.
They're very good about that. They're ruthless about killing people that you have grown to love. And I hated it in the beginning, but now I got used to it. So I don't want to read about it, so I would know.
You wanted to present no spoilers.
No spoilers for that one.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. And I also binge watch them, so you know.
With Walking Dead, did you not start watching it from the beginning?
I did. So
Right.
So the first, you know, how they do half and half season.
Yeah.
So the first year, yes, I watched it, you know, weekly. And then I got tired of it because I was too anxious for the next one. So
mm-hmm.
I thought, okay, I control myself and not watch it for a half a season. Wait for it to be ready. And then I can binge watch in one day.
Oof. Thing, you know? And then you keep your nightmare to just a couple nights instead
exactly,
of like week to
exactly.
week. Yeah.
And it gives me like weeks to think about it, because mm-hmm. I like, you know, to rethink what they've done. So.
What is your plan for surviving a zombie apocalypse?
That's a good one. Get a gun for sure.
Yeah.
Even though I'm not a pro gun person, but definitely.
Right.
I already have a grand plan. You know, grab the first SUV you can, drive as fast as you can to the gun shop.
Yeah.
Raid the gun shop as much as you can. Then go to a grocery store and raid the grocery store, and then start thinking about where you're gonna be
mm-hmm.
if you get surrounded by zombies for months at a time. So,
yeah. So guns,
food,
location.
Location, yes.
Can you kill a zombie with a gun, or is that to kill other people before they take your food?
That's going too dark.
But you need a gun.
Yes, I need a gun. Just to kill the zombies.
To kill the zombies.
let's hope.
Yeah.
If it happens, I'll be kind of human being that will kill other human beings.
Right.
Although I can see why movies like that, they do that.
Yeah.
And I'm one of those people who watch a movie and try to find faults all the
mm-hmm.
time. You know, miscontinuity, which sometimes movie do, which I love to catch those.
Yeah.
With The Walking Dead, is like, my God, why haven't you fortified your building yet? You know,
right.
You've been like, you know, because one season to another, a year has passed and you have done nothing to fortify. You know,
yeah.
You have nothing to dig, you know, dig a big ditch to make a drop in there. So,
yeah. Do you think it would be better to be in a high rise? Like, or would you rather be in like a country house that you can see them coming from all around you and like dig a moat?
Yeah, I want to be on a hill.
Okay.
But not on a high rise because you're trapped.
Mm-hmm.
I want to be on a hill. If I have time and enough people around me, dig a moat.
Yeah.
But also think about how you can escape that area. So you need some drawbridge or something
right.
so you can escape if you have to. So you have to have an escape plan, of course.
Yeah. Have you ever read the book Station 11?
No.
Okay. No. It's it's a book about an illness. It's about a plague that kills most of the population in a matter of weeks. But one of the main characters, a friend calls him from an ER and is like, go to the store and buy everything. And it's a story of this guy, like, in a snowstorm with, like, 11 carts of groceries and water and kind of in the middle of the night taking it up to his apartment in a high-rise building and trapping himself in the building until it seems that, like, it's safe to leave and go see what happened to the world.
Mm-hmm.
So your plan, according to that author, works well.
Good. Yeah. No, I've watched enough movies to know high rises don't work.
Right.
Well, I should read the book. I just took a note to read it. So.
It's also an outstanding audiobook. If you ever listen, if you're a book listener, the audiobook of that one is very well done.
Okay. Yeah, we'll do that. Yeah.
When you're trying to get someone into watching zombie shows, because at this point, The Walking Dead is intimidating. It's a lot of seasons.
Yeah.
What's an entry point for someone who's like, maybe I do want to watch a zombie movie, or what's an entry point to the genre?
I think I would go with a comedy one, like Shaun of the Dead, because it's lighthearted, it's funny. It has lots of the elements of what a zombie would do and can do. Another good one is 28 Days Later.
Because
it's not really about zombies as much. It is, but it's not. But the one I really liked, if somebody sort of said, I hate zombie movies, you know, it's called The Cured. I think it's an Irish movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's about zombies who are actually in cured, you know, they got some medication, they're no longer zombies. It's a love story, with a sort of a not so happy ending, but it's a love story. So the love story, you know, is a dominant part of the movie. The baseline is all zombie and zombie issues without really zombies running around and fighting you. So that's like a, I thought that's like a fantastic way of looking at the world post-zombie apocalypse.
When zombie becomes a chronic illness that you manage.
For example. Obviously, it has a parallels to everything
we
do. But I thought it was a lovely, low-key movie. That, and it's a great love story. And you all, everybody loves love stories. So it's like, and I hate zombies, like, watch this one because maybe watch other movies. Yeah.
Does your family get in on zombie night with you?
Not at all. Yes.
No.
That's a solo project.
Okay. All right.
Yes. No. It's me and myself to watch zombie movies. That's not their thing.
I like that you've recommended a comedy and a love story because I do think, I mean, zombie stories get pretty violent.
Yeah. That's what other movies who sort of use zombies as a staging ground, a setup versus, I think that's what The Walking Dead has, you know, evolved into more. You know, I know in the beginning they had to really go crazy with it, but I think they do less and less of it now.
Yeah.
It's more about really how we sort of how behaving towards each other rather than how zombies are dealing with us. Right?
How you reconstitute your society after a disaster.
How reconstitute society, how people take advantage of each other, how we become more of a tribe than we are now. Tribalism to the extreme.
I had a friend who did some of her master's thesis about zombie movies and just the zombie movies in different eras and what they were really commenting on. You know, is it racism? Is it, to me, it sounds like if there's a cure for zombies and then there's a love story, to me, like right away, that feels like it's a HIV commentary.
Hmm.
But that also might be my, I'm a product of when I was a teenager. So, but did those themes jump out to you when you watch them or does that sink to the background for you?
No, it does. I mean, The Cured was like, when I watched it, that's relatively recent, obviously pre-COVID, but post the HIV sort of mega thing. But I can see whoever wrote this, that they were thinking about how we would behave toward other group, the otherness of society.
Right.
And because they had to carry a card, you know, so it was like they were sort of a second-class citizen, even though we were pretending they were not, or the movie was pretending they were not. So it was, I mean, I do look at the social aspect of it in the zombie movies. And I know my wife Maria thinks now it's all gory and it's disgusting. But to me, right. Yes, if you're past the goriness of it, there is good ones. There are lots of bad ones, and I watch them all. So it's not like, you know, I don't necessarily discriminate. I watch anything. I go to Amazon or Netflix and just search for zombies, and whatever there is, I watch.
Yeah.
But the good ones, and they're rare, but the good ones can be really deep.
Mm-hmm.
And say something about our society in general and the direction the society is taking. So you can think about climate change and how climate change will change and impact us. And the population decline, which is coming up in the next 30, 40 years. You know, although it's growing now, but it's going to decline. And so the climate change and the population changes and the aging of our humanities. That's close to a dystopian that we can be without really being in a zombie. So that's what interests me, how we are going to behave toward each other and how we're going to build our new society. Not necessarily for my daughters, but for my daughter's children.
Right.
Because they're going to be in a hell of a world.
Right.
It's going to be a complex world by then.
There was another series I read. There's a word in a computer program that is like the automatic go. It's not, I don't think it's pseudo.
You don't mean pseudocode, no. You don't mean
that. No. Well, I will, by the time I do this, I will fix this in the show notes. But it was, I think, a trilogy. And it was, I spent a year where I just kind of read dystopian fiction. I started with Neal Stephenson, and I kind of went from there. And I think this was a Daniel X something. And this was a world that posited there was a billionaire, and he had this program set to start when the Google alert with his obituary got published. And so his death set into set the domino chain of catastrophic world events. But the second book in the series was then what happens when you rebuild the society, and it had stuff about agrarian culture, or, you know, like after a giant wave of violence, what can come from it? I've got to look. I got to do a little quick Google. This is killing me.
That's right. I know. Nowadays, something goes to your head, you have to look it up. Yeah.
Daniel Suarez. The first book is called Daemon, and the second book is called Freedom. So it was about what do you do? How do you rebuild society? And I feel like there was a good bit in there about, isn't there in Iceland like a special place where we keep seeds, heirloom
yes.
seeds?
Yes, we do. Yes.
Yeah. So how do you get access to those heirloom seeds, and how do you elevate indigenous agrarian culture or, you know, practices that we've ignored for so many generations in the Western world as a way to try and stabilize society?
Right. No, I mean, it's going to be,
yeah.
imagine us relearning how to just imagine when there's no electricity, and because without electricity, there's nothing, right? Actually, I think there was a TV series about that, like the electricity just goes.
Right.
We need to relearn. A lot of us will die, but we have to relearn how to build things, plant things, grow things. Yeah.
But I won't
things
do well.
Can happen.
Yeah.
Nor do I.
I don't have a lot of practical skills for a zombie apocalypse.
No, nor do I. I think I'll be eaten first, so.
As you look at your radar of characters you're getting to know, is there a zombie screenplay in your future?
No, I cannot write science fiction. I love reading science fiction, but I cannot write science fiction. It's, I'm too much of a scientist to be writing a science fiction sometimes. I whenever I write, I think about people and how they interact with each other, and the way I write is very organic. I don't set up the environment. Mm-hmm. And I think for a good science fiction, you need to spend a lot of time just to set up the world first.
Yeah.
And, so my brother has asked me to write a book with him because he had this idea about how the future might look like.
Yeah.
And as you probably know, then so the birth rate is falling, but also there have been some impact on the egg production of women, and the newborn boys have become of a smaller penis. Mm-hmm. So this sort of forever materials is in all of our bodies. So it's impacting how we are. So he was thinking maybe in the future, everybody's asexual. There's no sex at all. There's no sex drive. So we have to create babies somehow. And that's probably possible. Anyway, I'm trying to write that for him, with him. And just because you have to set up that world that is maybe 200-400 years from now.
Yeah.
Maybe earlier. I've been struggling with that.
Yeah.
So I've been writing, but I'm writing it as if I'm writing a more of a relationship story.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm leaving the technical part of it with him to build the world around the characters I'm writing.
Yeah.
So I've realized it's not me. I don't have it in me to write it. Yeah.
I don't either. Because I do enjoy science fiction and to some extent dystopian futures, which are less, I enjoy them less now than I did 6 years ago, maybe. But I really appreciate good, strong world building. An author I think who does it well is Jasper Ford.
Oh, yes. I love Jasper Ford. Yes.
The Thursday Next series, which is such a reward if you grew up, if you're a reader, he just writes gifts for you.
Yes, he does. Yes. He's a writer's writer.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think he does such strong world building. And I really hope that because the sequel to Shades of Grey, I don't think was ever released. Maybe I've missed it, but that's the one where the social hierarchy is based on colorblindness.
Mm.
I just think he's such a powerful world builder.
He is. So I reached out to him to say how much I love his book.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote back. And I wrote him and said, I know you're probably not going to answer.
Mm-hmm.
Probably one of your staff going to respond. But whatever, I just want to say how much I loved your book. And recently, the rabbit, I forgot the title of it, I forgot what it's called now. I'm like, oh my God, I was so disappointed at the ending. I wanted it to be like the love story to be fulfilled. And he writes back and says, what staff? I have no staff. What are you doing? Oh. Yeah. I thought that was like, so him.
Right.
Jasper Ford. And yeah, his Thursday Next books are just amazingly good.
They're so good.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're so good. It is often when people are looking for a summer read, and I know that they're readers, I'm like, start with The Air Affair. Everyone else in the world had not actually read Jane Eyre. So there were some of the things that in the manuscript that I didn't recognize what the problem in the story was.
Right.
But Jane Eyre is enough in pop culture that I wasn't too out of the loop.
No, right. No, I mean, obviously, his literary references are amazing.
Mm-hmm.
I've read Jane Eyre, but because of him, I had to go back and look up stuff.
Yeah, I enjoy playing with the idea that whatever happens to the original manuscript trickles down, and the idea that the characters, that they have a whole life when they're not being read. I just love the idea that there's this whole other world of the characters hanging out. And it's like, oh, no, wait, my page is coming up and running on stage of the book.
Right.
It's fantastic.
Right. I think you would recognize in the last chapter of my new book of influence of Jasper Ford.
Ooh.
So you will, because I said, you know, I live with my characters.
Mm-hmm.
So but like his book, my characters, when they start, they're faceless and they're genderless in some ways. And I'm just talking to them and they're just doing stuff and little by little grow, like his books. And even sometimes when the book is over, they stay with me.
Yeah.
Because they complain to me about how come I didn't give them more lines. It's either a sign of insanity in me, and that's fine, because I'm somewhat insane, I'm sure. But also, sometimes they keep it, or when the editor takes out the whole section.
Mm.
Obviously, I'm angry, but it manifests itself in the character coming yelling at me for letting them down. Yeah, letting them down. Yeah. So the last chapter is a sort of a dedication to them. So.
Oh, I'm excited to read it.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm not Jasper Ford, obviously, but his influences.
And you also said, I mean, obviously we've jumped into books, reading and writing. What is on your, like your bedside table or what's your current to read? Are you one book at a time or do you read in parallel?
I do two books at a time.
Okay.
So what am I reading right now? I'm reading Sorrow and Bliss by Meg Mason.
Mm-hmm.
She's a Kiwi that lives in Australia.
Okay.
And I'm also reading this short stories and novella. It's called The Office of Historical Correction.
Mm-hmm.
It's by Danielle Evans. And she's also a wonderful writer, which I just discovered. So I'm reading them both at the same time. I love reading both at the same time because I can jump. And for work, obviously, I read boring nonfiction books.
Are you paper? Are you digital, audio books? No,
definitely paper.
Yeah.
I get my newspaper in paper and I get my books.
So
I love books. I love that I can go back and forth in the books and I can find the places versus, I get the idea of digital. Obviously, it's great. And my iPad is full of books and it's great to carry it with you when you travel.
Mm-hmm.
But it's rare for me to read things on iPad.
And what about when you write? So first you talk to your characters for a year. You get to know them.
Yep.
And then do you write on legal pads or are you a... Are you pen to paper or a keyboard?
I'm definitely keyboard because although I'm not a medical doctor, but I write like a medical doctor, so nobody can read my handwriting, including myself. So if I write longhand, I wouldn't have no idea what I've written. So I sometimes take notes. I'm like, what did I write here? What am I meant to say? Yeah. So I stopped doing that because like middle of the night, you wake up and think of something. No, I just wake up and take my phone and write a note on my phone.
Yeah.
But no, I have my little MacBook Air for writing only.
And mm-hmm.
I have it with me. I try to write at least a sentence a night.
Okay.
I write every day.
Yeah.
I have a day job and my day job sometimes is just annoying and tiring.
Yeah.
But the pleasure is when I go home.
Yeah.
I can just write a sentence or two, just random thoughts that I may have had about some other book I'm writing or the conversation I had the night before.
A question that kind of consumed my social group, our fireside chats this summer because of COVID, we got a fire pit and spent a lot of time around a fire pit in the last year and a half, is I've learned that some people don't have an inner monologue. So when you are talking to your characters, do you hear your characters or do you just kind of like feel them?
Most often I hear them.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's just a feeling or just a location. But most often is as if I'm talking to you, I talk to them.
Yeah.
I visualize the world as much as I can. So I think like a movie.
Yeah.
I love movies. So I just see this world they're in. And as I said, most of my characters began with just generic, and then they take shape.
So in your mind's eye, you can see Imani and Dahlia's apartment and walk in and walk up the steps and go to the kitchen.
Right.
Okay.
Right. Obviously, you know, realistically, this, obviously from real life, I've seen it somewhere.
Or yes, of course.
In your head, of course, right? I'm not that good of imagining. But yeah, I mean, initially I was thinking how their house looks like, what kind of books they had on the bookshelf,
mm-hmm.
what kind of tables they had, what kind of rug they had. Was it Persian rug? Was it, you know, full floor?
Yeah.
What colors? Just that was just in the beginning, just so as I think about their home and how I would live in that home.
Yeah. Great.
But it's good. Yeah. It keeps me sane, so I don't have to kill my faculty and stuff. No.
Yes. Yeah. No, it's lovely. And you said that you'd been writing, and your biography said that you were writing as a kid when you were growing up in Tehran.
So I've been writing forever.
Yeah. So did you, when you were going to elementary in Tehran, did you study English, or you studied Farsi and then started learning English here?
I mean, we studied English. That was English is the second language in Iran, but not really well. I came to the country with almost nothing.
You know? Yeah.
So, I mean, basic ordering food type thing, no more. And then, you know, after I arrived, I think on Thursday, I was in school on Monday.
Oh. So,
yeah. My sister was
brutal
about that. Yeah. And, you know, it was a struggle, obviously.
Yeah.
First year was definitely a struggle. You know, and my brother was a few years younger, so he was 11.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's that age, perfect sweet spot, and he came right that spot. So it was very easy for him to learn the language. And some people have better brain for it than others, and I'm not pretty good at that. And also, I'm very shy. So all that combined made me very hesitant to speak. And, so it took me a while. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you ever do drafts in Farsi?
No,
do your writing in English.
I do, because my Farsi schooling is eighth grade, really.
Sure.
So eighth grade writing. And it's been a couple of decades since I've read a book or a newspaper in Farsi. And so my language still in Farsi is, in a formal sense, is dead. Mostly, I mean, I'm fluent. I can speak it. So conversationally, I'm fine.
Yeah. But
could I give a lecture? No, I was actually giving a talk to Iranian Scholarly Society in Los Angeles. And I cannot give that in Farsi.
Yeah.
I don't have the language to give something to such a
formal. You have 1977 teenager Farsi.
That's right. Which is like order food, buy something, chat with my parents.
Has there ever been a window when you've been able to go back?
No, I could never go back. My brother has gone back. I couldn't go back. Initially, neither of us could like because of the war with Iraq, which lasted 10 years. Then I got into national security work in the U.S. And I don't think it's smart for me to go.
No. A lot of people would have a lot of questions about that trip. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Not necessarily U.S. side. I think U.S. wouldn't care. I think Iran will think I know more than I do.
Mm-hmm.
And they want to know what I know, which I don't know. You know, I cannot tell him anyway, and I don't know a lot. So that could be an issue. And my older brother, who came much later, he worked for the defense. And like, he always like, nope, you're not going to Iran. So, no. So I've never, my siblings go back and forth, but not
Are there any dishes or foods that for you are transport you to Tehran?
It's been such a long
time.
It's been such a long time. What I remember the most is cream puffs, the little cream puffs. That only good memory because my mom used to buy them for me. And to me, that's like remembering my mom more than the food.
Yeah.
But, I only moved to New Orleans 5 years ago. So before that, California. California is full of Iranians now.
Right.
And every product you can think of that would be in Iran is in Los Angeles.
Okay.
So there's nothing, and you don't miss anything because everything is there.
Yeah.
Yeah. you know, Los Angeles is called Tehrangeles because there's so many Iranians there.
I went to a Jewish conference and there was, it was called Jewlicious, and there were a lot of Persian Jews there.
Yes.
And which was, I'm a Jew from Chicago, so it's not a part of our community that I have a lot of exposure to. And we got there and I was just like, it was one of the most like diverse Jewish like conferences I went to because it was mostly college age and right. And it was really super fun.
No, in Los Angeles, I think a large number of Jewish people are Iranian.
Yeah.
My publisher, Abram, he grew up in Beverly Hills. And in Beverly Hills, I think the first language is Farsi, not English.
Yeah. So I believe it. I believe yeah. it. Great. Well, Mayar, is there anything about your book or zombie movies that I haven't asked you about that if we hang up, you'd be so disappointed?
No, I think, well, thank you so much, because as I mentioned, I was very nervous about this whole thing. So it just, I looked up and like, my God, it's an hour. And I didn't realize
right.
an hour passed. So you're a fantastic interviewer.
Thank you.
No, I'm glad you started the book and I'm glad you liked it. And I was floored that you know Jasper Ford because he's so I love him and it's just great that it's nice to meet somebody else who loves him as much. To me, writing a book has always been a personal thing. It was always for me. And I hardly showed it to anybody except my wife. You know, mm-hmm. my wife was the only one who actually read any of my manuscript. And it wasn't until 5-6 years ago that I became brave enough to actually show it around and shop it around. So the whole thing is very new and scary to me.
Yeah.
And for a person with English as a second language, a mathematician, engineer, let's say.
Yeah.
Come into the world that is so foreign and then relatively doing okay. I'm happy. I'm happy with what I'm doing. And the fact that others outside of my family are reading the book. That's like,
yes.
That's perfectly good.
Yeah. To be on your fourth work of published work of fiction is really exciting. Yeah.
It is definitely exciting. So no, I hope whoever reads it like it, especially this one, because I try to make 8 short stories that connect
mm-hmm.
with characters coming in and out of each book,
yeah.
each story. I hope it worked. I read it and thought it works, but then obviously I'm biased. So. I like this one the best. The previous book was more about me and my friends and mm-hmm. my family, and I don't like to write about ourselves too much.
So. Yeah.
Yeah. So no, this has been great. So thank you.
Thank you. And do you want people to follow you online? Are you on Twitter, Instagram, TikTok? Any of the social media sites?
I'm not on Twitter. I'm not on Facebook, but I'm on Instagram.
Okay.
And it's amuzigar_author.
All right.
Yeah.
Great. And so people
I started with eggs and bacon because I thought it's a fun thing to have.
Yeah.
And then recently I thought, okay, it's silly. I give it up. And I had a few thousand followers. Believe it or not, I have a few thousand followers for eggs and bacon, which is crazy.
I believe it.
Thank you. Which yes. is like the most crazy thing. So I'm like, okay, that's silly. I'm going to move to people who actually want to read. So
yeah.
I just create a new one.
So formerly Eggs and Bacon.
That's right.
And now amuzigar_author. We'll link to it in the show notes so people can follow
Thank you so much.
Thank you. You can follow me. I'm at Chicago Leah on Twitter and TikTok. At Shy Leah on Instagram. Finding Favorites is at Finding Faves Pod on Twitter and Instagram. And please follow, like, and review.
Thank you for listening to Finding Favorites with Leah Jones. Please make sure to subscribe and drop us a 5-star review on iTunes. Now, go out and enjoy your favorite things.